Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, June 11th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. We'll start today on the first page, as usual, and the headline reads, Contract for Police in Schools, Up for Debate. New data shows racial gap in CR school suspensions, by Grace King. The number of Black students and white students suspended from the Cedar Rapids Community School District's high schools during the 21-22 academic year is virtually the same, despite Black students making up only 18% of the district's population. The data on suspensions was released Friday as the district continues to look at school safety while reviewing disparities in how students are disciplined for allegations of crimes and rule violations. The suspension data is part of a presentation Monday to the school board as members vote on a new contract to keep school resource officers, police, in schools. The 7-member school board and Cedar Rapids City Council last fall amended its school resource officer agreement with the goal of reducing the overall number of students being charged and also the disproportion of being charged. Iowa Department of Human Rights data last year showed that Black students in Cedar Rapids schools were 6 times more likely to have allegations of criminal wrongdoing made against them than white students. While the number of students charged has drastically decreased this year, the number of students suspended has remained steady. The district broke down suspension into categories of Black or African American, white, Hispanic, or Latino, and 2 more races. The number of students suspended during the 2019-2020 academic year is fewer because school ended early that year to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. That number also is fewer during the 2020-21 year because repairing buildings after the 2020 derecho caused a delay in starting classes. The suspension data and a new contract for school resource officers will be presented during a board meeting at 5:30 p.m. Monday at the Educational Leadership and Support Center, 2500 Edgewood Road Northwest. Suspension data for grades 9 through 12 in the high schools shows there were 15 in-school suspensions and 481 out-of-school suspensions during the 2021-22 school year. Of the 496 total, 192 incidents involved Black or African American students and 194 incidents involved white students. The number of suspensions during the 2018-19 school year was 1,041, with 418 of those being Black or African American students and 467 being white students. In grades K through 5, there were 148 in-school suspensions and 255 out-of-school suspensions during the 21-22 school year. Of the 403 total, 141 were for Black or African American students and 109 were for white students. The number of suspensions during the 2018-19 school year was 566, with 202 of those being suspensions of Black or African American students and 226 being white students. In grades 6 through 8 in Cedar Rapids Middle Schools, there were 300 in-school suspensions and 975 out-of-school suspensions during the 21-22 school year. Of the 1,275 total, 440 incidents were for Black or African American students and 527 were for white students. The number of suspensions during the 2018-19 school year was 1,610, with 619 of those for Black or African American students and 602 for white students. The district's discussion for renewing a deal keeping officers in the schools comes after multiple school shootings in Iowa and beyond, including in Uvalde, Texas, the nation's deadliest elementary school shooting since the 2012 attack at Sandy Hook Elementary in Connecticut. The Cedar Rapids District removed officers from McKinley and Roosevelt Middle Schools in the 21-22 amended contract. The officers were instead assigned as floaters and responded to calls for service from K-8 school buildings. The new contract proposal considers removing 2 floater officers and having 5 officers serve the high school buildings, including Polk Alternative Education Center, 1500 B Avenue Northeast. If the floater school resource officers were to remain, though, they could be placed at the Cedar Rapids Police Department instead of in the school buildings, and their title changed to responders, according to board documents. During the 21-22 academic year, school resource officers were called for 33 incidents at Cedar Rapids K-8 schools. If the proposal is approved, school resource officers would be placed at Jefferson, Kennedy, Washington, and Metro High Schools and Polk Alternative Education Center, according to the contract. The contract proposes officers be required to wear soft uniforms when on duty as a school resource officer, which includes a polo shirt with a police logo and khaki pants. While this was a part of the amended contract, it was not strictly followed. If approved, the contract would run from July 1, 2022 to June 30, 2023. The number of students charged with crimes decreased during the 21-22 school year compared with the 2018-19 and 2019-20. Fewer than 50 students were charged during the 21-22 school year compared with 225 during 2018-19, according to board documents. White students and black students were charged about equally, but black students make up a much smaller share of the student body. A survey about the program was sent to high school students, staff at Kennedy, Washington, and Metro high schools, and all high school families at the end of the 21-22 school year. Respondents include 11% of high school students, 27% of high school staff, and 3% of families. A similar survey was sent out in spring 2021 and received a 39% response rate, or 1,854 responses. The most recent survey received an 11% response rate with 527 people. Almost half of students responded that they feel very safe having a school resource officer in their school, an increase from 30% in 2021. 41% responded they feel somewhat safe, 7% feel somewhat unsafe, and 4% feel unsafe having an officer in their school, an increase from 2%. The majority of students responded they feel very comfortable or somewhat comfortable with their school resource officer. 8% said they feel somewhat uncomfortable, and 4% said they feel very uncomfortable. The majority of students responded they had a very positive or somewhat positive experience with their school resource officer. 4% said they had a somewhat negative experience, and 1% said very negative. Over 90% of students agree or strongly agree that their officer is a positive role model in their school. 9% said they disagree or strongly disagree with that statement. Over 90% of staff and families who responded said school resource officers make students feel more safe and are needed. Next headline reads, Sub-Zero plans expansion into Cedar Rapids. Appliance manufacturer envisions 192 new full-time jobs, by Marissa Payne. Wisconsin-based refrigeration and appliance company Sub-Zero is seeking city and state incentives to build a $140.6 million light manufacturing facility in Cedar Rapids that would add nearly 200 full-time jobs, most considered to be at the high-quality wage rate. The Cedar Rapids City Council is slated to consider a term sheet Tuesday outlining preliminary points of a deal with the company and the developer, an entity of Tiffany Earl Williams, to build a 400,000-square-foot building at 10,015 6th Street Southwest, east of the Eastern Iowa Airport. The proposal calls for a minimum investment of $90 million in real property and improvements and $50.6 million in machinery and equipment, according to documents. Once built, the project will result in the creation of 192 full-time jobs, 127 of which would be paid at or above the high-quality rate of $24.20 an hour. If approved, the company would receive a 20-year, 75% tax exemption on the increment value generated by the project, subject to meeting the employment thresholds. The city would provide a local match through its above-standard economic development program. The Iowa Economic Development Authority Board is set to consider incentives through its High Quality Jobs Program at its June 17th meeting. Work is expected to start in August 2023 and wrap up by August 2025. This is a major accomplishment for the city, City Manager Jeff Pomerantz said. We feel very excited about welcoming Sub-Zero to our community. They're going to be a great employer for the city, and we look forward to a long relationship with them. This is a major step to bring this company to our city. Pomerantz said the city is extremely pleased about the level of wages for the employees, and Cedar Rapids has worked closely with the family-owned company and other partners to bring Sub-Zero to the city. The Cedar Rapids Metro Economic Alliance helped with company meetings and visits to potential properties. Kirkwood Community College provides job training for employees, and the state's high-quality jobs economic development program, if approved, will provide key funding to the development, Pomerantz said. He also acknowledged the business community's efforts to attract Sub-Zero and pitching why the company should locate here. Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell said the project was a big win for Cedar Rapids and an indicator of the city's momentum. She said Sub-Zero would fit well in the city and help it get to the next level. Cedar Rapids should feel particularly proud that this family-owned, multi-generational company chose our city after a very competitive search process, O'Donnell said. We have the people, we have the culture, we have the values, we have the educational development support that a world-class company like Sub-Zero looks for. Located near the airport, between Walford Road and Wright Brothers Boulevard Southwest, this part of town has seen a boom in construction. Cedar Rapids has attracted growing manufacturing, warehousing, and logistics and distribution companies, among others, thanks to easy access to the airport and the highway network in the southwest quadrant. Some other major projects nearby include a $108.6 million, 479,000-square-foot FedEx Ground Distribution Center on Commerce Park Drive Southwest, slated to wrap up in the fall. A multinational aerospace company, BAE Systems, is expected to open a 200,000-square-foot classified defense aerospace facility worth more than $170 million later this year. West Ibaki launched the Sub-Zero company in 1945 after experimenting with refrigeration in the 1930s, in part searching for a way to store insulin to help his young son, Bud, manage his juvenile diabetes, according to the company's website. Sub-Zero's launch marked the introduction of the first system for storing food at ultra-low sub-zero temperatures. O'Donnell said her father was a salesperson for Sub-Zero in the late 1980s and early 90s. She said she brought that personal story to the company in business recruitment visits. It's a point of personal pride to have a company that was part of my life growing up to choose our city, O'Donnell said. It's wonderful. A development agreement finalizing the deal would be approved at a later date, after the council and IEDA consider tax incentives. The last article on page one is headlined, Groups Ask CR to Yank Landlord's Business License. Rental house has been declared a nuisance by city, by Trish Mahaffey. Neighborhood associations and a not-for-profit organization fighting systemic injustices have banded together to demand the city of Cedar Rapids revoke a property management company's business license. Eric Gutschmidt, president of the Wellington Heights Neighborhood Association and a landlord, said he and others from the Beaver Park and Moundview Neighborhood Associations and the Advocates for Social Justice decided to send the letters to the city after last month's arrest near a rental property owned by Charles Davison, operating as property holders. Earlier this week, the house was declared a nuisance property by the city. The house at 1748 C Avenue Northeast has had numerous reports by neighbors of gunshots being fired there, which has resulted in bullets coming through their homes, the Gazette reported in May. The house was under surveillance by the Police Community Action Team, which focuses on gun violence, last month when Royal R. Jones, 19, was arrested. He was charged with being a felon in possession of a firearm, one without a serial number known as a ghost gun, along with three other charges. He was arrested after running from the house under suspicious circumstances, a criminal complaint stated. In the letters to the city, the associations say Davison has been unable to manage and prevent rentals from becoming nuisance properties. There have been multiple incidents of people associated with the property shooting weapons in the neighborhood or illegally possessing weapons, but Mr. Davison has not been inclined to discontinue renting to this group of tenants, one letter to the city stated. When another of Davison's properties on Beaver Avenue Southeast was declared a nuisance, the tenants had to move. Davison rented 1748 C Avenue Northeast to the same tenants. An employee of Davison's lived in the Beaver Avenue house, police told the Gazette last year. Neighbors confirmed the tenant moved into the C Avenue home. The neighbors are terrified, the Moundview letter stated. Their homes have been hit by bullets. They are afraid to let their small children play outside, afraid to contact police, afraid to invite grandmothers over to celebrate Mother's Day or have a graduation party outdoors like others in Cedar Rapids do, with no second thought to safety. The Advocates of Social Justice also said property holders was preying on vulnerable people that struggle to make ends meet by entrapping them in unsafe properties and using tenants' financial struggles as leverage to not fix or upkeep the homes, its letter to the city stated. The associations asked the city to revoke Davison's business permit so he can't move the tenants to another of his properties. Mari Davis, administrator of Property Holders, who runs the day-to-day operations, said she is working with the city on the progress being made on properties that still have derecho damage and has been working with Safe CR over concerns neighbors have about the C Avenue house. The company also has been doing routine maintenance and repairs that occur as a part of the inspection process, Davis said. Several properties have met the requirements this past year and have passed the inspection. I would point out, as I did previously, that the tenants who occupy the property at 1748 C Street Northeast are also victims, as the home has also sustained damage from gunfire that unknown individuals have engaged in, Davis said in an email. Further, the tenants have not, in fact, been arrested for any criminal activity, as neighbors allege. Gutschmidt said three rental properties he owns across from the 1748 C Avenue house have been affected by the shooting incidents. His tenants had bullets coming through the walls. One of his tenants moved out, he said. Gutschmidt, the Advocates for Social Justice and other community advocates, circulated a petition last year, gathering over 1,250 signatures, and called on city officials to permanently revoke Davison's permit to lease property in Cedar Rapids. This came after the City Housing Board of Appeals took the unusual action of suspending Davison's rental permit for 2307 Beaver Avenue Southeast and three other properties, all deemed nuisances, for 6 months. The city, however, didn't revoke his rental permit. There are housing laws and due process to be followed, which allows property owners time to come into compliance. Davison didn't rent these properties during the suspensions and came into compliance on the nuisance issues. Greg Bulow, City Housing and Nuisance Manager, said the city has received the Neighborhood Association's letters and is currently processing and evaluating the proper steps in accordance with law, affording due process to the affected parties. The 1748 C Avenue house was declared a nuisance property June 6th, and a nuisance abatement plan is due June 22nd, said Amanda Greider, Public Safety Program Manager. The owner has until June 16th to appeal. Moving inside the paper to local and regional news, this is from page 2. Senators Ernst, Scott discuss education, politics in CR. Republican presidential hopefuls should be geographically strategic in Iowa, party chair says. By Grace King. U.S. Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina praised Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds on Thursday evening, saying the Republican Party should be the party of parents. Scott, touted as a possible Republican presidential contender, spoke with U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, R. Iowa, at an interview-style discussion moderated by Republican Party of Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman at Elmhurst Country Club in Cedar Rapids. Education forms leadership of the next generation, said Scott, the only black Republican in the U.S. Senate. Your great Governor Kim Reynolds is fighting tooth and nail to make sure there is quality education in every zip code in the state. Scott said he is fighting for the same thing, focusing on transforming the country through quality education. Following reception, Kaufman said that being seen with Reynolds is a positive in the Republican Party, especially with the national exposure she's received. I don't think anybody whose popularity and the ease of which you're going to see her being reelected has triggered longer coattails, he said. Kaufman said GOP candidates visiting Iowa have not mentioned a run in the 2024 presidential election, but they are asking, how can we help? A presidential candidate should make it personal, like Scott did Thursday evening, Kaufman said, and be geographically strategic when visiting Iowans. So far, Scott has visited Linn and Scott counties in Iowa. Kaufman said Scott needs to head north and to the Missouri River next. Iowans pay attention to that, Kaufman said. We're very regional in our thinking, and we expect the candidates to go where potentially they can be heard by every single citizen. During the reception, Scott threw Ernst's name into the ring as a possible presidential contender. I know that one day when you're over all the military or the vice president or the president of this country, I so look forward to saying, yes, ma'am, Scott told Ernst. The senator spoke about racial equality and the U.S. withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan last year. I ran for Congress in the place where the Civil War started, and I won because of the evolution of the human heart, and the Southern heart continues in the right direction, said Scott, the first black person elected to the U.S. Senate from a Southern state since Reconstruction. You hear we've never lived in a more racially divisive time than right now, Scott said. Did we miss the Civil War, the 60s or 70s or race riots? Did we forget that this country evolved to elect an African-American president and now an African-American vice president? Ernst said she's tired of hearing from Department of Defense officials that climate change is the most pressing issue facing the United States. I don't want to hear that anymore when we have Russia, who has invaded Ukraine, and creating a global food crisis, when we have Afghanistan, which we left in such a dishonorable way, leaving Americans behind, our Afghan allies, and our allies and partners from other countries, Ernst said. Now we have the Taliban ruling, and you see the rights of women and girls slip away, and violent extremist organizations that once attacked us in 2001 reconstituting in the same exact same stamping grounds, Ernst said. We do have to focus domestically and make sure our nation is secure, Ernst said. If we don't have security and safety, nothing else can follow. Continuing with regional news, UI sues over cracked windows. Children's Hospital contractors have not accepted responsibility. By Vanessa Miller. The University of Iowa is suing two contractors who installed 900-some windows in its 14-story Stead Family Children's Hospital, many of which have proved defective, with delamination and cracks showing just 5 years after the hospital's opening. UI Healthcare in April 2021 went to the State Board of Regents asking to spend another $10 million to $15 million to replace two floors of damaged windows, which they first discovered in July 2019, 2 years after the opening. An extra $15 million pushed the total hospital cost, already ballooned from $270 million to $392.7 million, to $407.7 million. As part of the new expense, UI installed a protective film and clips to secure the windows and mitigate potential safety concerns. The campus also closed the new children's hospital playground out of an abundance of caution. Officials have stressed the defective windows don't pose a threat to patients, employees, visitors, or the public. No one has been harmed, although the windows need to be replaced and are being monitored. In October, after first alerting Regents of the problem, UIHC reported finding more flawed windows needing the temporary emergency safety film. The university hasn't yet started replacement work, although UIHC officials in 2020 initially hoped to install replacements in summer of 2021, according to documents obtained by the Gazette. UIHC Interim Chief Executive Officer Kimberly Hunter said the lawsuit, filed in Johnson County District Court on Friday, comes after an extensive good-faith effort to resolve the issues with responsible parties. We're disappointed that we've had to get to the point of filing a lawsuit, Hunter told reporters. But we really need the contractors to address the issue. We contracted with companies to provide windows and install them with an expectation that they would work appropriately and not have defects, and that didn't happen. Contractors being sued include Iowa City-based Knutson Construction and Couples Construction of Illinois. Hunter didn't share specifics about how much the university is seeking in damages. The construction of the Children's Hospital was an investment in Iowa, and we relied on and paid contractors to deliver a high-quality product, Hunter said. Unfortunately, the contractors have not accepted responsibility for replacing the defective windows, so we are forced to file a lawsuit. In addition to windows encasing the curved Children's Hospital, UIHC must replace delaminated windows on a bridge connecting the new facility with UIHC's Papa John Pavilion. The university has put that bridge portion of the window replacement project out for bid at an estimated price of $2.4 million, with a return date set for June 14th. Officials earlier this year said bridge work is expected to start in September and wrap in June 2023. UIHC, dating back to June 2020, has contracted to pay Marv's Glass of Iowa City more than $1.3 million to install the protective film on the damaged windows. And it has increased the budget for a consultant hired to investigate the windows to nearly $1 million, all of which is encompassed under the $50 million total cost umbrella, officials have said. When UI first hired Chicago-based Simpson, Gumperts & Hager, or SGH, in 2019 to look into the problems, a UI attorney told SGH its consultation came in anticipation of potential litigation in connection with the construction of the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital. UIHC officials have denied the Gazette's requests for a condition assessment report that SGH produced due to potential litigation. In April 2021, UI Senior Vice President for Finance and Operations Rod Lennertz told Regents the campus, for now, would cover window costs with building usage funds. We are and will continue the effort to establish causes related to this and intend to hold responsible the causing parties, he said at the time. There are both manufacturer and installation questions being addressed through study, and we will continue to garner more information on that as we continue this. $5 million in water quality funding announced by state and feds. Infrastructure funding called unprecedented by Aaron Murphy. Iowa water quality projects and programs will receive $5 million in federal funding over 5 years as part of new resources announced Friday by state and federal officials. The funding from the federal infrastructure bill that was passed by Congress in November 2021 is being dedicated to 12 states involved with a federal task force that is designed to reduce pollutants that flow from the Mississippi River to the Gulf of Mexico, killing sea and plant life in a dead zone there. The funding was announced at a joint news conference with Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig and representatives from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. State and federal officials called the new federal funding for water quality unprecedented. Naig said the funding will help scale up existing programs designed to reduce pollutants in Iowa's waterways and will help fund the creation of more wetlands which meet the same goal. One of the key topics for discussion in the task force is around funding. You can have a strategy, you can have a plan in your states, but do you have the resources that you need to implement? Naig said during the news conference. So the funding being announced Friday is critically important to helping states accelerate the adoption of conservation practices in their priority watersheds. Scientists at Iowa State University in 2008 created the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy, an action plan designed to provide guidance for how the state can reduce the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus pollutants in its waterways. Iowa was one of the 12 states involved with the federal Mississippi River Gulf of Mexico Hypoxia Task Force, and Naig is a co-chair and the task force's top state-level representative. The federal task force's other co-chair, EPA Assistant Administrator for Office of Water, Radhika Fox, also spoke at Friday's news conference. Fox said she believes the new funding will supercharge efforts to accomplish the task force's goal of reducing nutrients in the Mississippi River by 20% by 2025. In an investigative report called Treading Water, the Gazette wrote in 2018 that the task force originally set a goal of cutting nitrate and phosphorus pollution by 45% by 2015, but then pushed the goal back by 20 years. Despite millions being spent by the states on water quality efforts, the Gazette investigation found the average size of the dead zone still was about 3 times larger than what the task force had set as its original goal. The report found efforts by the states to reduce pollution were unfocused and underfunded. I think what's incredible about these resources is that we're going to be able to invest in conservation practices that help our farmers thrive, their businesses thrive, while protecting water quality, Fox said Friday. It's an incredible moment, and I just can't wait to see the work that is going to unfold over the next 5 years because of these resources. Coralville Council expected to pick Jones to fill seat. Retired banker would take the place of member who resigned, by Isabella Zaluska. Keith Jones, a retired banker and longtime Coralville resident, is expected to be appointed to the Coralville City Council next week. Pending formal council approval, Jones will fill the vacancy on the council created in April when Councilmember Jill Dodds resigned. The council is expected to approve the appointment at its meeting Tuesday evening. Once approved, Jones would be sworn in after the vote and participate in his first meeting as a council member. Jones will serve on the council until the November 2023 election. Jones' experience and community involvement stood out to the council. Last month, the council voted 3-1 to appoint someone to fill the vacancy rather than hold a special election. The council weighed both options and ultimately decided to go the appointment route because it would fill the vacancy faster and not have a cost attached. Dodds, a council member for a decade, resigned at the mayor's request following the arrest of Dodds' husband on a child sexual abuse charge. Her husband, Jeffrey Dodds, has pleaded not guilty to the charges, and a jury trial has been scheduled for October 4th at the Johnson County Courthouse, according to court records. 7 residents applied to fill the vacancy and were invited to be interviewed by the mayor and city council members Thursday evening at City Hall during a special meeting of the city council. In addition to Jones, the council interviewed Barry Bedford, Eric Gizendanner, Mackenzie Graham, Fong Nguyen, and Faye Vitito. Kent Christian applied but did not show up for the interview. The council asked the candidates a variety of questions, ranging from thoughts on the city zoning code and use of TIF, how to make the city more inclusive, how to engage residents, and the candidates' qualifications and priorities. Each candidate also was asked if they intended to run for council next year. In previous discussions and after candidate interviews, Councilmember Mitch Gross and Mayor Megan Foster said the advantage of incumbency should be given by the voters. Council members complimented what each of the 6 candidates would bring to the position, saying it was a tough decision as they discussed who to select following the interviews. The council ultimately came to the consensus that Jones was the best fit for the position, given his community involvement, experience, and intention not to run in 2023. "I've had a lot of experience working with Mr. Jones," Foster said. "I've seen his work firsthand. He's so soft-spoken and I think very humble about the impact that he's had on this community." Jones has lived in Coralville for 47 years. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, June 11th, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. William Earl Morrison, 72, of Belle Plain, passed away Tuesday, June 7th, 2022. Per his wishes, he will be cremated. Memorial service will be at 11 a.m. Sunday, July 3rd at Knoll Ridge Country Club in North English, Iowa. A remembrance ride will be held at a later date. He was born on October 21, 1949 in North English, Iowa, to Warren and Naomi Lockridge Morrison. On November 16, 1982, he married Betty Galope in Elk City, Oklahoma. He retired from Whirlpool Amana after 13 years of service. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be in care of the family. Online condolences may be left at iowacremation.com. Joan Lucille Hegewald was born May 22, 1930, in Washington, Iowa, the daughter of Richard and Willis Reed Greiner. She grew up in Keota and graduated from Keota High School with the class of 1949. Joan was united in marriage to Willard Lewis Hegewald on September 7, 1957, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Keota. Together, the couple made their home in Middle Amana. Joan worked as a tour guide for the Amana colonies for 20 years, retiring in 1999. She enjoyed visiting with people, getting her mail, Catholic faith, cardinals, doing crafts, sewing, and spending time with her children and grandchildren. Joan was a member of St. Mary's Catholic Church in Oxford, where she was active in the altar and rosary. She was also active in the Amana Heritage Society and Amana Artist Guild. Joan passed away Thursday, June 9, 2022, at Living Center West in Cedar Rapids at the age of 92 years. Celebration of life service will be 11 a.m. Tuesday, June 14, 2022, at St. Mary's Catholic Church, Oxford, Iowa. Visitation will be 9 to 11 a.m. at the church. In lieu of flowers, a memorial fund has been established for Mount Calvary Cemetery in Oxford. Powell Funeral Home Williamsburg is caring for Joan and her family. Messages and tributes may be left at powellfuneralhomes.com. Karen Sue Teig, 69, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, June 8, 2022, at Mercy Medical Center, Cedar Rapids. Funeral services, 1 p.m. on Monday, June 13, 2022, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, Cedar Rapids, with a visitation beginning at 11 a.m., burial to follow at Anderson Cemetery, Swisher, Iowa. Karen was born on April 18, 1953, in West Union, Iowa, the daughter of Freeland and Mary Brown Coots. She graduated from Jefferson High School in 1971. On March 6, 1970, Karen married Michael Teig. She worked in retail for several years, but her favorite job was taking care of her family at home. She will be remembered for her big heart, being a mom to many and a friend to all. Karen loved kids, especially her grandchildren. She made every holiday special, but Christmas was always her favorite. Karen enjoyed watching football, playing the guitar, and helping out at Trinity Lutheran School with the third grade students and the Boy Scouts. Memorials are suggested to the family. Please share your support and memories with Karen's family on her tribute wall at stuartbaxter.com. Karen Elizabeth Burroughs, 60, of Central City, passed away on June 9, 2022 at her home. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Marion is assisting the family. Karen was born on June 26, 1961 in Peoria, Illinois, the daughter of Kenneth and Florence Wolfschlag McAllister. On October 2, 1982, Karen was united in marriage to Jimmy Burroughs in Elmwood, Illinois. She enjoyed golfing at Meadowview, fishing, camping, Iowa women's basketball, and being with her grandchildren. Karen will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved her. Lila LeGrand Hansen, 66, of Bertram, Iowa, passed away on June 8, 2022, of cancer. Funeral service gathering of memories, 11 a.m. Monday, June 13, 2022, at the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, Mount Vernon, by celebrant Dawn Stevens. Visitation will be held 3 to 5 p.m. on Sunday, June 12th at the funeral home, and continue for 1 hour prior to services on Monday. Burial will follow in the Mount Vernon Memorial Cemetery. Lila was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa on March 20, 1956. She went to Washington High School. She was very much in love with her three kids, 11 grandchildren, and nieces and nephews. Lila liked working on cars and house projects. She loved camping with her family and always went above and beyond on the holidays, especially Christmas. A memorial fund has been established in Lila's name and may be directed to the family. Please share your support and memories with Lila's family on her tribute wall at stuartbaxter.com. That concludes today's obituaries. We'll move on to the editorial page. There's one letter to the editor today. It is from Jim White of Robbins. The title is, Iowans Pay the Price for Reynolds Policies. There is a practice in business called risk assessment and mitigation. It can apply to security, business processes, financial issues, etc. Its purpose is to clearly assess what bad things could happen and ways to minimize, as much as practical, the odds of them actually occurring. This activity crossed my mind while listening to the response from Governor Kim Reynolds about the latest shooting in Iowa. She's apparently going to work with people to fix a problem she created, with those costs, of course, being borne by us, not her. Put as many guns as possible into the hands of everyone in the state, let them carry them with no training, registration, or requirement of any kind, then head to the bank with your gun lobby money. And when the risk of those actions, easily assessed by any fourth grader, let alone a governor or legislative member, comes to fruition, push the cost of mitigating that disastrous policy to those who suffer the consequences. Great work if you can get it. Maybe if Kim and her friends had to pay for the funerals, the extra security infrastructure, the time spent on active shooter drills instead of education, their risk assessment might change. Right. Not to mention the completely unquantifiable grief inflicted on families that couldn't be compensated with all the money in the NRA bank account. Kim and friends get the payoff. We're left paying the price. Votes have consequences, serious ones. Again, that letter is by Jim White of Robbins. There's also a guest column by Peter Fisher, who is the research director at Common Good Iowa, a research and advocacy organization in Des Moines and Iowa City. It's titled Tax Cuts, Real Math, Real Harm. Iowans and the future of our state just took a licking. We might not see it fully for a couple of years, but that's the impact of massive tax cuts that will whack 40% off the income tax, the mainstay of funding for state services for all Iowans. And the cuts are so highly skewed in favor of those at the top that it is breathtaking. Many Iowans will see absolutely no benefit, while fully 82% of the tax savings go to the top one-fourth of taxpayers with income over $100,000. The average millionaire will save $62,000 a year. For those in the middle with incomes between $40,000 and $60,000, the savings will average just $300. That's about $6 a week. Almost 4 in 10 Iowa taxpayers, the majority of those with income under $40,000, will get nothing at all, according to the Iowa Department of Revenue. When fully phased in by 2026, the bill will cut $1.9 billion from general fund revenues. The entire state general fund budget this year is about $8.2 billion, with over half going to education, community colleges, the three public universities, and state aid to K-12 schools. The rest funds healthcare, infrastructure, public safety, state parks and recreation, child welfare, enforcement of labor, and environmental regulations. Chris Hagenow and Grover Norquist offered up their usual nonsense to defend these cuts in Tuesday's Gazette. Norquist is well known nationally for his strident promotion of tax cuts, followed by drastic cuts to public services. Ironically, the success of the Democrats' pandemic legislation has allowed Iowa Republicans to make such a massive dent in revenues without immediate consequences. The current budget surpluses are largely the result of the stimulus checks, the increased child tax credit and child care credit, and the unprecedented pandemic unemployment compensation. These supports to the Iowa economy will wane and the surpluses will erode, assuring a need for substantial budget cuts. It is simple math. Removing nearly a quarter of state revenue will harm education. Already squeezed, school funding will not keep pace with inflation and will fall below what is needed to provide quality education. The state share of post-secondary education funding has fallen from 2/3 to 1/3 in 20 years. It will continue to fall and tuition will rise, leaving parents and students with higher bills and higher debt. Funding for mental health, affordable child care, and water quality will be scarce. If we want Iowa to be competitive for workers, for teachers, for nurses, for families with children, for college grads, and yes, for business, we need to focus on what we offer to make Iowa a place to live and raise a family, with opportunity and vibrant, healthy communities. These massive tax cuts will make us less competitive. Sitting on a $1 billion surplus, the legislature could have strategically funded public education, affordable housing, mental health, better water quality, and child care access. Instead, they chose tax cuts that will cost Iowans dearly, at least those who stay. Again, this is a guest column by Peter Fisher, who is research director at Common Good Iowa. And here is the Gazette fact checker, which appears on page 2. The headline is Ernst scores mixed grade on rising gasoline prices. Introduction. The rising cost of gas is straining Americans' budgets and fueling heightened criticism of Democratic President Joe Biden. Iowa's Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst is among the critics of his energy policy. While no one president of either party can be entirely blamed for market volatility, the person in the White House often becomes the target when Americans see higher prices at the pump. The combination of inflation and increased consumer demand as the U.S. shakes off the fiscal toll of COVID-19 were already contributing to rising gas prices. But there's also now a worldwide shortage of crude oil supply resulting from Russia's invasion of Ukraine, as countries around the globe abruptly ended their reliance on Russian oil and gas. Ernst tweeted May 26 that within the past 2 weeks, gas prices have jumped 33%. Some experts are saying the price will reach $6 a gallon by midsummer. The Biden admin must unleash U.S. energy independence. Analysis. On the first claim that gas prices jumped 33% in 2 weeks, an Ernst spokesperson pointed to an Associated Press article published May 22nd, reporting that the average U.S. price of regular grade gasoline spiked 33 cents over the past 2 weeks to $4.71 per gallon. That means the price of gas was $4.38 the 2 weeks before. An increase in gas prices by 1/3 in 2 weeks would have actually bumped the cost to about $5.83 per gallon. According to AAA, even the current national average price for regular grade gas, about 2 weeks after Ernst's tweet, is $4.986. It's possible there was a typo in Ernst's tweet confusing 33 cents with 33%, but ultimately she overstated the size of the increase. Gas prices have certainly surged over the last year, up much higher than last year's average of 3.073 per gallon, according to AAA, but such a jump did not happen in 2 weeks. Grade F. On the second claim that gas prices would rise to $6 per gallon by midsummer, Ernst's staff pointed to a report from J.P. Morgan analysts warning of the effects of U.S. oil companies selling more gas to other countries as global demand for oil increases because of the war in Ukraine and sanctions on Russia. There's a disconnect between low supply and higher seasonal demand. If exports persist at this elevated pace and refinery runs, already near the top of the range for reasonable utilization rates, fall within our expectations, gasoline inventories could continue to draw to levels well below 2008 lows, and retail gasoline prices could climb to $6 a gallon or even higher, according to the J.P. Morgan Global Commodities Oil Flash Note. CNBC, Yahoo, Business Insider, and other local media outlets reported on the J.P. Morgan analysis. Prices already are around $6 per gallon in places such as California. Other forecasts predict prices will fall. GasBuddy on May 19th, for instance, expects the average price from Memorial Day to Labor Day to be $4.40 per gallon nationally, though significant events could raise or lower the outcome, falling from a Memorial Day weekend average of $4.65 per gallon. but it's unclear why Gas Buddy's prediction is that prices will fall this much when AAA reports the current average to be 4.986. Ernst did say some experts. The JP Morgan analysis came from a credible, widely cited source, and gas already is at that price in California. Given current trends and volatility, it seems very possible prices could climb to $6 by midsummer. Grade A. Criteria. The fact-checker team checks statements made by Iowa political candidate office holder or a national candidate office holder about Iowa or in advocacy ads that may appear in our market. Claims must be independently verifiable. We give statements grades from A to F based on accuracy and context. If you spot a claim you think needs checking, email us at factchecker@thegazette.com. Now let's move to some sports news. From the first page of the sports section is an article by J.R. Ogden titled Season Starts Now. Summer is work time for wrestlers at Iowa State across the country. Kevin Dresser has been around wrestling a long time. He said that during a recent Cyclone tailgate tour stop at the Marriott and knows what it takes to reach the top. He wrapped up his fifth season as Iowa State's coach in March, but before that was an NCAA champion at the University of Iowa in 1986. He was a highly successful high school coach in Virginia who took two different teams to 13 state titles. He coached Virginia Tech to 160 dual wins, three ACC dual titles, and two conference tournament championships. He knows how to win, and he knows you don't win championships in June. But he also knows you definitely can lose titles during the offseason, if there really is such a thing, if you don't have belief, buy-in, and focus. For guys like Dresser, and just about every coach on the planet, the next season starts the day after one season ends. For Dresser, it was watching Penn State win another national championship in March. You've got to know where the bar is, Dresser said. Right now, Penn State is the bar. Dresser's 21-22 team finished a fantastic 15-1 in duels, but fell short in March, placing third in the Big 12 championships and 17th at the NCAA championships. That won't cut it for a guy who wanted to win the first week on the job. Iowa State, however, is trending in the right direction. Dresser knows this, but nothing matters more than the results on the mat. And that starts before June. That continues today, tomorrow, and the next day. You've got to train to get to that bar, he said. We've got to have a great summer, and we've got to understand what the competition is. If you don't know what's out there, then you don't have focus. We need to be real focused on what's out there. Iowa State will have three All-Americans in its lineup when the season actually starts in November, including 2021 national champion David Carr. It's been a long time since Iowa State had multiple returning All-Americans, Dresser said. There are others in the room who fell short last year, but Dresser feels they are on the brink of better days, and there's a recruiting class that ranks as high as second in the country by those who rank such things. That class includes junior national champion Casey Swiderski from Dundee, Michigan, one of the top overall recruits in this class. There's also M.J. Gayton of Temecula Valley, California, and Manny Rojas from Bay City, Michigan. There's Connor Uten from Ohio and Ethan Perryman, another Temecula Valley product. All are ranked among the top 100 recruits in the nation. I'm excited, but ask me in 4 years if they live up to the hype, Dresser said. There's also five Iowa preps, including Cedar Rapids Xavier's Christian Stanek. It's a big class, a lot of names from all over the country. Worldwide, baby, worldwide, Dresser said with a laugh. Kennedy versus City High, a must-see. Cougars claim both games of Thursday's doubleheader, 5-3-5-4, by Jeff Linder. The names and the faces have changed, and frankly, so have the circumstances. But City High Kennedy softball remains an event. Cedar Rapids Kennedy's next generation of pitchers showed promise, and the Cougars overcame a grand slam by Iowa City High's Avi Lindsay to sweep the Little Hawks 5-3 and 5-4 in a Mississippi Valley Conference doubleheader Thursday night at Kennedy High School. We're young, but we have a lot of young potential, a lot of young talent, Kennedy coach Madison LeClaire said. But there's a lot of learning left to do. Stars like Ayana Lindsay, Carrie Koenig, and Ella Cook, City High, and Kaylin Kinney, Jamie Sheck, and Mia Dodge, Kennedy, have moved on to the NCAA Division I programs. Expectations aren't as high for either team, both of which have been state tournament regulars recently, and neither is the pressure level. Still, it's clear both of these teams are capable of going on a surprising postseason run. It's a process for us, City coach Jeff Koenig said. Where we're at today, we want to be a little better tomorrow. And in both games Thursday, the Cougars, 10-4 overall, 10-2 MVC, were a smidge better than the Little Hawks, 6-11, 6-8. A play here, a play there, and things might have gone the other way, Koenig said. One of a handful of remaining veterans who played on Kennedy's 2020 state championship team, Keaton Gerber, said games with City High are fun games. It's competitive, so it's fun. I like how it always seems to go back and forth with them to see who can get the energy up when they need to. A freshman, Ella Brown, 4-2, scattered 9 hits in the opener, striking out 2 and walking 2. Addison Knutson, 4-1, an 8th grader, fanned 10 and walked 6 in a 3-hit Game 2 effort. They're both really solid, said Gerber, who hit a solo home run in the second game. I didn't think they'd be confident enough, but they are. LeClaire said they're young. They're 14 or 15-year-olds against 18-year-old batters. There are going to be learning moments. The fact that I'm going to have one of them for 3 more years and the other for 4, I like to see that. Now in racing news, this one's titled Cherishing Every Moment. William's grateful that Hawkeye Downs allows him to pursue passion, by Justin Webster. Johnny Williams is one of many second and third generation drivers pushing Hawkeye Downs Speedway toward its 100-year anniversary. I live 5 minutes from the track, Williams said. We have 2 kids and my wife and I both work a ton of hours, so it benefits my family to race at Hawkeye Downs. Williams started in go-karts at age 13 and after graduating from Benton Community High School in 2005, moved up to the Hornet Division in 2007 at age 20. It was pretty crazy, Williams said, of moving up to a real race car, just the surroundings are so different. Racing always has been in the Williams family, with Johnny's uncle Jim owning Advantage Chassis, which has built the framing for many of the cars at Hawkeye Downs, including most of the Hornet Division. Originally from Atkins, Williams was a summer hire at General Mills 9 years ago when he joined his father, Chuck, who has been with the company more than 30 years. At General Mills, Williams met his wife, Michelle, and the couple with 2 kids, Madison, 4 years old, and Ben, 5 months, will celebrate 6 years of marriage on July 2nd. Michelle allows me to work on the cars or go racing, and that sacrifices her time, Williams said. Her support means a ton. Now racing in the Sport Mod division, Williams is thankful Hawkeye Downs provides him a place to pursue his passion. It's pretty impressive that Hawkeye Downs is still going, Williams said. I wish they could get more cars, but I think Brian Gibson and Jay Crable are getting it going in the right direction. On the track, Williams said he races how he likes to be raced with respect for his fellow drivers. That led to Williams finding Victory Lane 2 weeks ago, a moment the 35-year-old has learned to cherish. You never know when it'll be the last victory, so you have to celebrate in the moment and take it all as best you can, Williams said. Wins are hard to come by, and you never know when the last one is going to come. Williams sat third in the point standings heading into last night's races with 2 wins and 3 top 5 finishes. And a brief local sports note from the first page of the sports section about girls basketball. Courtney Jones, hired by West Liberty. Former Iowa City High and Illinois basketball player Courtney Jones has been hired as the new girls basketball coach at West Liberty. The oldest of 5 basketball-playing sisters, Jones played in 122 games with the Illini. One more article in our last few minutes. Bridge Under Bridge renews hunt for new home in CR. Finding new location for the food truck feeding those in need has proved to be difficult, by Elijah Decius. For the second time in 2 months, Bridge Under the Bridge is searching for a location to call home. The nonprofit started in August 2020 to provide free hot meals to those in need after the 2020 derecho was open for 1 day at its second location. The organization, run by Bridget Williams Robinson and her husband, Javante Robinson, left the ROC Center on 10th Street Southeast after serving there on May 4th. Williams Robinson said the location wasn't a good fit for her family and the organization's needs. With several meetings set up for next week with various property owners in Cedar Rapids, she hopes to secure a new location soon. Finding a permanent location for their food truck has been a lot more difficult than you'd think, she told the Gazette, with as many businesses and empty lots and places that aren't even being used in the city. It's the luck of the draw at this point, she said. I don't know more. I wish I did. At the end of April, Bridge Under the Bridge was forced to leave its original spot under Interstate 380 on 8th Avenue Southwest after receiving notice from Linn County. Linn County, which leases the land from the Iowa Department of Transportation, received complaints over several weeks about debris and maintenance of the site. Linn County Supervisor Ben Rogers previously told the Gazette the county needed to take action to comply with the terms of its lease in order to avoid losing the land. Though Williams Robinson said it's hard to be picky about where they're allowed to stay, Bridge Under the Bridge needs a location appropriate for the clients it serves, preferably in a central area, accessible to those in need of food, and along a bus line. Like First Avenue, 8th Avenue carries a lot of traffic through Cedar Rapids, which made the location even more accessible and visible for those in need. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, June 11th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.